Hello, my name is John Calladine, and welcome to this podcast on the fundamentals of charity accounting. You may have listened to a previous podcast introducing you to charity accounting and encouraging you to get involved, and I hope this podcast will deal with more technical and practical issues and give you a better understanding of what it is to be a charity accountant. I hope to be running a master course on this subject in the spring of 2011. Do check the AAT website for further details and information. Firstly, one has to understand what a charity is. The days are long gone when you could call yourself a charity. Act accordingly and avoid inquiries from HM Revenue and Customs and the Charity Commission. It is now necessary to register, most certainly with HMRC, and if your income is over £25,000 per annum, than the Charity Commission also. Indeed, if you try to register with HMRC, you will find a long and detailed form wanting lots of information before they will consider giving you what they call charitable status, let alone inquiries from the Charity Commission itself. The Charities Act 2006 clarifies what is a charity. The Finance Act 2010 actually gives a definition which relates to the Charities Act 2006. The basic purposes for which a charity is set up are either 1. Prevention and relief of poverty. 2. Advancement of education. 3. Advancement of religion. 4. Advancement of health. 5. Citizenship, community development. 6. Arts, culture, heritage or science. 7. Amateur sport. 8. Promotion of human rights. 9. Advancement of environmental protection. 10. Relief of those in need by reason of youth, age or disability. 11. Advancement of animal welfare. And finally, number 12, and most importantly, any other purpose beneficial to the community. This is the default position and is always useful as long as you can prove that the activities are charitable. A further requirement brought in by the Charities Act 2006 is that the charity has to prove it is set up for public benefit. That is, it has to benefit a wide range of people. There are two key principles of public benefit, and within each principle, there are some important factors that must be considered in all cases. These are as follows. Principle 1. There must be an identifiable benefit or benefits. Therefore, it must be clear what the benefits are. It should be possible to identify and describe the benefits provided and be quantifiable, like providing housing for the homeless. Unquantifiable projects will be taken into account as long as it is clear what they are. The benefits must be related to the aims, and the benefits must arise from the charity's work. So other benefits which arise which are not related will not be taken into account. When a charity has more than one aim, each of those aims has to meet the public benefit requirement. It will not be enough if only some do. Then the benefit must be balanced against any detrimental harm arising. Examples: is the charity doing or damaging the environment or physical health of others? Judging whether detrimental harm occurs, the Charity Commission will need to see real evidence. They will not just assume it. Principle 2. The benefit must be to the public or a section of the public. Beneficiaries must be appropriate to the aims, although this is stating the obvious. And what constitutes the public or sector of the public varies according to the charity's aims. Sometimes the charity's aims are intended to benefit the public generally, sometimes a specific section of it. Considering who the charity intended to benefit is important in deciding public benefit. The number of people who can benefit must not be insignificant, although the number of people who can be beneficiaries can be quite small, as long as anyone who could qualify for the benefit is eligible. The opportunity to benefit must not be reasonably restricted by geography or other restrictions, or the ability to pay fees where charged. People in poverty must not be excluded from the opportunities of benefit, and any private benefit must be incidental. Religious charities have to be careful that they are not isolated and narrowly defined, and that their activities are for the public benefit. Care homes, which are perhaps set up as charities, also need to prove that they are not just businesses. Ways round this would be to offer subsidised or free accommodation for certain classes of adults. It is interesting to note that the first round of consultation by the Charity Commission on the subject of public benefit highlights some rest homes which fall short of the mark for charitable status. Private schools are vulnerable to attack under the public benefit rules, primarily because they may be considered that they only benefit a certain section of the public, those who can afford to pay the fees involved. Ways round the public benefit test may be offering free scholarships to underprivileged children, opening up the school and its facilities for the use of the community, and liaising with state schools. There are various forms of charities with different legal formats. For example, 1. A company limited by guarantee registered under the Companies Act. 2. An unincorporated charity. This could be set up by a trust deed or a simple constitution run by a group of trustees, or it may just be called a management committee, or in a case of religious charities, it becomes either deacons, elders, or parochial church council. It has to be remembered, in the case of unincorporated charities, that the legal entity does not have limited liability protection unless it seeks specific insurance cover. Any borrowing or legal arrangements are entered into in the name of the trustees, the management committee, or the parochial church council, or whichever governing body oversees the work of the charity. There are charities called accepted charities, who were not registered with the Charity Commission. They were primarily religious charities, armed forces charities, or scouts and guides groups. Although they had to follow the format of charity accounts, registration with the Charity Commission was not mandatory. Since the Charities Act 2006, this has now changed, and all these charities with income in excess of £100,000 per annum have now to register. And it will be necessary for those accepted charities with income below that threshold to register in the years to come. At the present time, under the Charities Act 2006, any charity with income below £25,000 per annum does not have to register, although it is still subject to the rules and regulations of the Charities Act 1993 and 2006. There are also charities called exempt charities, but these relate to large national bodies like museums and galleries, and are outside the scope of this podcast. Let's now turn to charity accounting, how to prepare charity accounts. Charity accounting follows the usual accounting policies and precedents and basic accounting standards. There is a fundamental SORP, that is, Statement of Recommended Practice of Accounting for Charities, which was issued in March 2005, which basically is the rulebook of all charity accountants, independent examiners, and auditors. This is an excellent publication available from the Charity Commission and can be downloaded as well. Company charities will, of course, have to follow the rules and regulations of the Companies Act 2006, but cross-reference to the SORP 2005. And of course, accrual accounting is mandatory because they are companies. Unincorporated charities will follow the Charities Act 1993 and the Pacific Charity Accounting Regulations as issued from time to time by the Charity Commission. Accrual accounting is required with income over £250,000 per annum. However, below that level, unincorporated charities need only prepare a receipts and payments account, and a short statement of assets. This can be very useful for the smaller unincorporated charity with low levels of income. These accounts do not have to follow the SORP, as that document specifically relates to accrual accounting and charities with income over £500,000 per annum, although adoption of the SORP is considered best practice. An advantage of receipts and payments accounts is that you can use your own headings for receipts and likewise for expenditure, rather than follow the SORP headings. All charities will have to prepare a trustee's report, similar to a director's report. For the smaller charity, only basic information is necessary, but for bigger charities, especially those over the audit threshold, much more detailed information is required, as set out in the SORP. All charities with income above the threshold of £25,000 per annum will need to have an independent examination of their accounts and records, whether incorporated or unincorporated. Charities with income over £500,000 per annum will need to have a full statutory audit carried out by a statutory auditor. Charities with income above £250,000 per annum and gross assets exceeding £3.26 million require an audit, even if its income is below the £500,000 threshold. Charities above the audit threshold have to follow the SORP 2005 as mandatory. Below that level, it is best practice, although there are still mandatory provisions. Charities with income above £250,000 but below £500,000 require the independent examination to be carried out by a qualified accountant. It can be an AAT member, ACCA, or a chartered accountant or chartered management accountant or public finance accountant. However, it is interesting to note that charities with income below £250,000 do not necessarily need a qualified accountant to do the independent examination, although it is recommended that the examiner has sufficient skills and experience in charity accounting to be able to carry out the work. Do not let the expression fund accounting worry you. It is similar to the business world, where there are separate divisions for different activities. However, the most important area of charity accounting is to differentiate between restricted funds, unrestricted funds, designated funds, and endowment funds. Separate figures have to be provided for each of the various funds involved. Unrestricted funds are funds that are available for the use of the charity within the general objects and powers of the charity, basically being the core work. Designated funds are monies put aside by the trustees from unrestricted general funds. Designation must be specific and may be time limited, for example, roof repair fund or new building fund. There are no reasons why monies cannot be transferred back from designated funds to the general fund if the purposes of the designated fund cease. Restricted funds are those given for a purpose that is narrower than the general objects of the charity, but still fall within the specific requests as determined by the donor. These could be for a specific project or for a specific purpose and are restricted. That money has then to be kept and controlled within the separate restricted fund. It is important to note that a charity cannot act outside its objects. The objects are usually set out in the trust document or memorandum and articles of association, and quite often are worded widely. However, if it is a narrow, defined charity, that charity can only act within the words of the Constitution. If a charity is set up for the welfare of dogs, then it cannot act in the welfare of other animals. Therefore, if a charity is set up for animal welfare, and money is specifically given to the welfare of dogs, then that has to be restricted to its own fund. It is advisable when acting for a charity to suggest that the charity keeps its marketing material widely worded. If not, then the specific appeals for a new building or project makes the money restricted, and this has to be controlled and accounted for accordingly. Funds which are held on trust for the future benefit of the charity are endowment funds. If the capital cannot be spent, although it can rise and fall in value, it is a permanent endowment. If the capital can be spent, in prescribed circumstances, it is an expendable endowment. Within the conventional commercial business accounting world, statutory accounts require a profit and loss account. They pay tax and dividends and retain profits. However, in the charity world, this is replaced by the statement of financial activities, called a SOFA, which then includes all income and expenditure, recognised and unrecognised gains, and they are then subdivided between the various funds of the charity. The various different types of funds also have specific categories of headings to follow, and these are mandatory for charities with income over £500,000. Details and explanations of these headings can be found within the SORP 2005, and they are quite distinct and specific to follow. Many charities are involved in projects for which they receive funding from government departments or other grant-making charities. Incidentally, sometimes these funding projects ask for a full audit or a full reporting to be made of how the money has been spent and accounted for. I did not mention it earlier, but it is not unusual to find in a trust deed that a full audit is required anyway, whatever level of income the charity is reporting. Charity accounts have to distinguish the support costs, which relate to various projects, and therefore in the areas of expenditure, costs have to be allocated across. It is necessary to report costs relating to activities involved in generating funds, also activities relating to various charitable projects, and stripped out between each project, as well as costs relating to the governance of the charity. There are no hard and fast rules as to how costs are apportioned, but they need to be disclosed, consistently applied, and to be fair in all the circumstances. Further details are found in the SORP. A further specific area to charities is the gifting of time and services, as well as goods to a charity. In theory, these have to be disclosed within the charity accounts, although materiality needs to be applied, as well as common sense. Lots of charities use many numbers of volunteers, and it is not always possible to put a value on this work. However, if the charity is receiving significant time and services from a volunteer, for example, a professional, and it is possible to value the time, then this should be disclosed in the charity accounts. You credit income received, debit the appropriate cost centre, and show it in the SOFA. Within the balance sheet of the charity, headings are similar to any sort of commercial form of accounting. However, instead of having reserves called profit and loss account or capital reserves, these are replaced by the balances on the fund accounts. It is interesting to note that the disclosure notes relating to charity accounts are far more detailed and complex than those we find for the standard small or medium-sized enterprise. SORP 2005 does give details, guidance on all these matters. One of the particular difficulties of charity accounting is the recognition of income. There are three very useful words which are found in the SORP: certainty, entitlement, and measurement. These definitions are applied to all sources of income being received and determine whether that money should be recognised as income to the SOFA. For example, in the case of a legacy and a letter received from a solicitor at the year end talking about a specific legacy due to the charity, this money may not be received until after the financial year end. However, you have a letter confirming entitlement, certainty and value, that is measurement, and therefore this should be provided within the SOFA. A simple example, but one which sets out basic principles applied. I do hope that this introduction to the fundamentals of charity accounting is of help and of interest and gets you started. Thank you for listening to this podcast.